You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Okay, here we are. We're going. We've started Glenn Lowry at the Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, sponsored by the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown. I'm professor here of economics and professor of the social sciences. I'm talking with Coleman Cruz Hughes, who is, I believe, entering your senior year as a philosophy major at Columbia University.
Yes.
And Coleman is an increasingly prominent young African-American intellectual writing about issues of race, culture, and inequality, especially at Quillette.com, Quillette.com, which is a website, a webzine that publishes very interesting commentary on contemporary matters of social, political, economic, and so forth interests. And Coleman is contributing there. You've had a number of pieces posted there, if I'm not mistaken, Coleman.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many. I've lost count now.
Okay, so the question is, when's the memoir coming out? No, I'm kidding.
that's my question for you, Glenn. When's your memoir?
Yeah, man. Okay, very fair, because I promised the world 2 or 3 years ago that I was going to produce a memoir that I never produced, mea culpa.
And the world hasn't forgotten.
Life is complicated. It's not as if I haven't been doing anything in the interim. But I agree that this is important, which is why my wife, LaJuan, and I, my lovely wife, LaJuan, and I have set aside the month of June, and we have rented a cottage in the woods. I'm not telling anybody where because I don't solicit visitors. And I've got a pile of notes and incomplete things and draft. I got a ton of ideas. We could do a whole show about that, although that's not what we're supposed to be doing. But I'm definitely, you will, you know, talk to me on July 1st. On July 1st, 2019, I will have a piece together, a lot of different strands, and we'll have at least a presentable draft that I'll begin to circulate. I don't have a publisher. I don't even have an agent anymore, although I signed on with an agent, but I'm so long overdue to produce my manuscript. So there you are. There you are. Now, I wanted to talk to you, Coleman, because I was very struck by a particular piece of yours from over a year ago, or almost a year ago, in Quillette, Black American Culture and the Racial Wealth Gap, in which you take on this consensus argument about the fact of a disparity of wealth between blacks and whites, and secondly, of the extent to which that disparity is a congealed reflection of a history of racial oppression, and that, you know, sort of equal justice for African Americans can only be achieved by in some way or another addressing that disparity. And you want to examine the sources of that disparity. You don't dispute the fact that it exists. And that takes you into the realm of talking about African-American culture and more generally of talking about how it is that we want to parse this question of, given the mistreatment and discrimination in the past of African-Americans, what responses are appropriate in the present day. That's right on up to the issue of reparations, which has become a topic of debate. So perhaps we could begin, if I may, by asking you to summarize a bit the structure of the argument that you offer in that essay, Black American Culture and the Racial Wealth Gap. I mean, I might just add culture. You know, you're taking on this big kind of elephant in the room, bugaboo, culture. You're daring to talk in explicit terms about racial differences in culture and the consequences thereof. So I just invite you to take a minute or two to describe what you're after in that essay, and we can take it from there.
So I split the essay into three parts. The first part was giving a summary of what I view is the progressive consensus on what is the cause of the racial wealth gap, which is far larger than the income gap between blacks and whites. And I identified two main factors in the you know, progressive narrative, the first being slavery, and the second being a suite of racist New Deal policies or New Deal policies that whites benefited from that blacks didn't, foremost among which would be the FHA loans, government-backed loans that went almost exclusively to whites that made it easier to get access to homes that then appreciated in value in the 40s and 50s. So in the first part of the essay, I just challenged both assumptions. You know, the first being slavery as a main cause of wealth in America. This is, as a matter of economic history, I think is, you know, it's obviously a very complicated story, but I don't buy the narrative that slavery is the main driver of wealth historically for virtually any of the major enslaving nations. If you look at, for example, how is Portugal doing today? It's like maybe the 30th wealthiest nation, and they imported the most slaves of any country into the New World. So, like, not, and then countries like Singapore, which were themselves colonized, are now wealthier per capita than the countries that colonized them, like Britain in that case. So I think there is kind of a lazy assumption that slavery, it's kind of based on this deeper fallacy that if one nation is wealthier than another, they must have plundered it from someone, which there's this assumption sometimes called the lump fallacy, that wealth is just there to begin with, and the question is how we divide it up. But in reality, wealth is created and continually created. So I was questioning that assumption about slavery, first off. Second off, I was questioning the causal story about how big a role redlining played in the creation of the wealth gap. Not questioning that it played any role. Clearly, you know, the ability to get in, you know, to make a down payment on a house easily in 1940 meant something as housing values rapidly appreciated. I don't doubt that that made a difference. I doubt, however, the extent to which that made a difference. What I argued against is there's this way in which people tell a post hoc story about explaining a disparity that we see today, with the unstated assumption that the primary driver of wealth creation in multi-ethnic societies is government favoritism from the top down. That's one element, but if you look historically throughout the world and even in America, that hasn't been the most important causal factor. So you could look at the Japanese in America who, there were laws on the books from 1913 to 1952 preventing them from owning land or property. And yet by 1960, the Japanese have a higher rate of college attainment than not only Black Americans, but white Americans, right? You could look at the Jews. There's no reading of American history in which America has been, you know, disproportionately kind to the Jews relative to, say, Protestants. And yet there was a study from 2003 I cite that found something like a 7-to-1 household wealth gap between Jews and conservative Protestants. So nothing has been more normal in America or throughout the world than for a despised minority with no political power to nevertheless have more wealth than the majority. And the second point I'll make there is that if we're going to tell this post hoc story about how a wealth gap was created just by government favoritism, that also should lead us to consistently to tell a different story about why Blacks are so dominant in the music industry or the NBA, for example. The story would have to be logically that the music industry was way less racist than other places, other sectors of society, which I don't think is actually true. I think Black people simply would not be denied in the music industry because the human capital in that narrow band was so obvious to people, Black and white. So that's like the first third of the essay.
Let me stop you there. Okay, well, if you have something else you want to say, go ahead.
No, that's all. That's all.
No, I just want to keep this in a manageable set of segments so that everybody who's listening can stay in touch with the full contours of your interesting argument. And, you know, I like to try to summarize when my guests present, as you just did, an extended statement, how I understand what it is that you're saying. So we're starting now with a critique. We have the wealth gap, and you're not disputing, you cited a 10-to-1 figure. We could go into some discussion about whether and how you measure and what that means. You know, these are the ratios of the median Black and white household. Okay, so you've got a survey, you've assessed the wealth of each household, you look at a distribution, the median is the 50th percentile, the typical half less wealth, half more wealth person, and then you take the ratio of those medians. I could give you a very long critique about why that's the wrong way of trying to measure the disparity of wealth, but I won't bore you with that. That's where we start.
Well, I heard someone say that the mean would be better, but I'm not sure that I agree with that. Maybe
you got distributions. Why not look at the whole distribution? You've reduced it down to a statistic. The median is one. The mean would be another, but you've got the whole distribution. So I can tell you what percentage of people have wealth above or below any particular level of wealth. And that's where the discussion should start. But these are quibbles.
Okay.
I mean, the main point is that because I think that numbers like 10 to 1, 30 to 1, 51 give a wrong impression. This is all I'm saying of some kind of, you know, anyway, I don't want to go into it because it's a secondary point. Your main point is about what are the sources of wealth? And the moral argument about the people who are making a big deal about racial wealth disparities, like Ta-Nehisi Coates or like my former graduate school colleague, the distinguished economist Sandy Darity, and his colleagues are making in their work about the wealth disparity, is you see there history casts a long shadow. You see there the dispossession of people, the plunder of Black bodies, Black wealth. Slavery is important here because it's an expropriation of labor. The labor of the slave is not allowed to accrue to the benefit of the slave and his or her descendants. It's rather expropriated the value, the surplus value by the slave owner. This dispossession, no 40 acres and a mule, no land holdings, et cetera, is the root of the disparity of wealth. And therefore, the disparity of wealth occasions the need for some kind of intervention like reparations, which would be a redistribution of wealth in order to rectify this historical dispossession. This is the argument. And your critique, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to summarize this, I won't go on very long, is no. The source of wealth is not just something that sits there. You call it the lump fallacy. I think that's an interesting phrase. It's not just something that sits there. This is a very dynamic system. And the counterfactual argument, had there been no slavery, there would be a very different distribution of wealth, you think, is refuted by observing for countries that were slaveholders, for areas of the U.S. that were slave-intensive, they're not necessarily more prosperous, and that for areas that were exploited or groups of people who themselves have been exploited, and we could add to your list, you know, you've got the Igbo in Nigeria who suffered the exclusion, you've got the Chinese throughout Southeast Asia who, et cetera. And this is all straight out of Thomas Sowell. I can see you've read and you are acquainted with your Thomas Sowell, because Tom Sowell, I will say the great Thomas Sowell, has been making this point for a very long time about discrimination doesn't imply or necessarily correlate in a one-to-one way with differences of wealth holdings or income or occupational status or whatever, because there's all these variations. And ultimately, this does come down to culture, which is the other thing that you want to talk about. But I just want to say a couple of things as pushback, okay, on your argument. The fact that Singapore is richer than Britain or Holland, and that Portugal is a relatively middling, almost a poor country, doesn't establish that 16th, 17th, 18th century wealth accumulation, a certain elite population in Europe that was a consequence of the slave trade wasn't real. That those two things are not necessarily the same thing for the very reasons that you offer. There's an evolutionary dynamic that's going on. So Singapore is a nation city state of largely Chinese entrepreneurial dynamic, aspiring and acquisitive and accumulative population. Yeah, they're richer than Portugal, but that doesn't mean that, or England or whatever, but that doesn't mean that the economic history of the 16th, 17th, 18th century and the evolution of global disparities isn't fundamentally influenced by the structure of relations and property ownership and industrial dynamic that flew out of slavery. I mean, it's like the connection between the thing that you're measuring, likewise the states. The states, that the thing that you're measuring and the causal claim that you want to make is very tenuous. The connection between those things is tenuous, just like the states. Of course, Mississippi is poorer than Massachusetts. I grant you that. Mississippi was a slave state and Massachusetts was not. Therefore what? Therefore slavery doesn't make you rich? No, come on. That's not a serious argument with respect. Massachusetts or New England, more generally, New York, Connecticut, there were insurance companies. There were banks. There were all kinds of interconnections of economic relations such that the fact of slavery and the economic, the cotton trade, the triangle trade, Atlantic system and whatnot, created the opportunity for surplus and for economic growth that well may have left a pattern of distribution that benefited the Northeast more than it benefited the planters.
Well, doesn't that imply, like, so most of the important patents that were made in America were made in the North, not the South.
Yeah.
Doesn't it imply that the thing creating more, you know, the human capital that was creating more value that was coincident with slavery was more coming from the North rather than the South?
I think that's
true. And it could be the case that all of the industrial factors, like that should be separate from the phenomenon of forced labor itself. You could have had an industry with wage labor. So the question is, isolating the variable of forced labor rather than wage labor, how much did that account as a main driver for the wealth of America? I don't think it was main. That's the point I was trying to make. But I concede that.
Well, let me just finish making my point. My point was that regional variation today in the wealth of the Northeast and the South doesn't prove the claim that the institution of slavery had no contribution to the accumulation of wealth, because it's an integrated economic system. And the specialized activities of the Northeast, such as you were just describing, like investment in innovation and human capital, may have been more valuable because of the fact that they were connected in an integrated system to an economy which was also partly driven by slave labor. You did not have to be an owner of slaves or participating in the agricultural sector of the economy in order to benefit from the fact of slaves or the existence of the agricultural sector of the economy. That would be a little bit like people arguing today that because Harvard University and Yale University sit in the Northeast and because all they do is grow soybeans in Ohio or Iowa, therefore the contribution to the U.S. economy, or making these silly, what I think are silly calculations, like they say, look at who pays into the federal government and look at who gets benefit from the federal government. Therefore, the states who are a net deficit in that they pay in more than they get are carrying the states that are a net, they take out more. Like, it's a system. It's an entire system. Let them stop growing the things that they're growing in the Midwest and see what happens to the U.S. economy. Eventually, it will affect the value of a degree from the Harvard Business School, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if I can make that argument again, I don't think I would make it with the North versus South comparison. So what I'm arguing against is the idea that America's wealth was created mainly on the back of slave labor, i.e. the counterfactual that but for slavery,
yes,
America might be just another middling country on earth. That doesn't make any sense to me. The Aztecs had slavery, but very little wealth. Slavery has been ubiquitous in civilizations for the past 10,000 years. So what is the variable that changed in the 1700s and 1800s? Clearly, it wasn't. It had much more to do with knowledge and skills and technology than it did to do with the phenomenon of forced labor. So I was taking issue with the Ta-Nehisi Coates line that this country, the economy of this country was built on the back of slaves. And therefore we all kind of are benefiting unwittingly from what was the main cause of American wealth, namely slavery.
I happen to agree with what you're saying. I'm glad you had a chance to clarify it. I happen to agree with what you're saying, that Coates and company, and it's not just him, vastly overstate the importance of plunder. And it won't just be limited to slavery. After all, the lands were appropriated from the native populations. They stole the land from the native population. The culture is built on plunder. It's built on slavery. It's built on the genocide, et cetera. They stole the land from the Mexicans. You know, they stole the Southwest from they, of course. They are we. I mean, let's not even get into that. Let's not get into who the national subject of these discussions are and how it is that Americans, all of us benefiting from the structures of a social organization, political development, economic enrichment in which we are situated, nevertheless divide ourselves up into these groups. And so the blacks are supposed to be, we identify now with the slaves. We sit here in the early 21st century rich. I digress, but you'll allow it, I'm sure. Rich by any measure. We're amongst the richest people of African descent ever to exist. We are so privileged. We have so much opportunity. There's so many things that are possible for us. We're rich. And yet we identify as second cousins of the Native Americans who were exterminated by the plundering, et cetera, and merely and only the descendants of slaves whose ancestors were dispossessed and so on and so on. So I have much sympathy with that. Critique that you're offering. And I just will add, and I know I'm going on a little bit, just give me another minute. I'll add, causally, as a causal matter, you're exactly right. The question is, Had I not had forced labor, had I had contract labor or wage labor, would the patterns that we're looking at be significantly different? To which I think we have every reason to answer no. So working class immigrants, Irish, in the northeastern seaboard from Boston down to Baltimore in 1840, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, wage laborers, working at barely above subsistence, exploited by any left-wing Marxist or socialist ideology. These were exploited working classes. Wealth was accumulated on their back. How much of American wealth is due to the exploitation of wage labor from 1850 to 1900 versus how much of it is due to the expropriation of slave labor from 1850 to 1900? I dare William Darity to make that calculation. I dare you. It's a head count. I'm just talking, let's look at the profits of companies that were engaged in the textile industry or in the whatever, in light manufacturing or in the whatever in the United States, which was the China of its era from the late 19th until the early part of the 20th century. Let's just look at what the exploitation, quote unquote, of wage labor contributed to the American economic dynamic. And let's just compare it quantitatively based on the value of the goods produced and so forth to any reasonable estimate of the contribution of slave labor to the overall accumulation of wealth in the United States. At best, those are going to be very close numbers. And my guess is the exploitation of low-wage labor will dwarf the contribution of slave labor if you made a quantitative calculation of it. So I'm trying to agree with you about that.
I take it.
Oh, okay. So you said something about the New Deal, and I want to ask you about this. Do you know who Ira Katznelson is?
Yes, when affirmative action was white.
Yes, Ira Katznelson, a professor at your university at Columbia of politics. He's at Columbia, and that is the book, When Affirmative Action Was White. I'll just say briefly. He says there was a New Deal. The New Deal, because it had, under the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s, to get through Congress, and because in those years the Democratic Party disproportionately consisted of representatives from solidly Democratic Southern racist constituencies in the old Confederacy, who were committee chairs and whatnot. The only kind of New Deal policy, what we're talking about here is Social Security, we're talking about aid to farmers, we're talking about aid to dependent families, we're talking about unemployment insurance, we're talking about wage and hours legislation, a minimum wage and so forth. The only way that he could get these bills through Congress was to accede to some of the racist requirements of these committee chairs to tailor the New Deal so as to not upset the hierarchy of racial domination that was characteristic of the South before the Second World War. And as a result, the welfare state that emerges in the U.S. is a constant to the 20th century without really a social economy, mainly a laissez-faire economy, but comes out of the Depression and the New Deal comes and all these institutions are created, which are a trillion-dollar level hit in terms of the magnitude of the impact that they're having on the structure of the U.S. economy. Blacks are left out. Maids and domestic workers and farm workers are not covered by the unemployment insurance and the minimum wage and hours legislation and whatnot. Administration of the farm aid policies and the welfare policies are left in the hand of local officials who are not subject to any kind of federal requirements or strictures that would ensure that they administered their programs in a racially equal way. And as a result, the net benefit of the welfare state was vastly disproportionately tilted toward whites and away from blacks. The New Deal leads to the GI Bill as a way of dealing with compensation to an acknowledgement of the service of people in the generation that fought World War II. But the armed forces were discriminatory in their rules about who could serve. And as a consequence, the eligible population for GI benefit. And so, you see how it's going to go. I don't have to go where Ta-Nehisi Coates goes to, redlining of housing markets and whatnot, although we could go there. I'm saying this is a big, large, huge, transnational, trans-economic, transgenerational, structural phenomenon. And it is, to some degree, racially biased. Do you deny that or the significance of that for contemporary inequality?
I deny only the outside significance that's been attributed to it by progressive scholars. The question of, A, yes, that happened. B, the counterfactual where that didn't happen almost certainly involves Black people having more wealth today. I don't see how it couldn't. The question is, if you're looking at the total wealth gap and you're trying to attribute on a percentage basis what factors historically drove it, I don't know where that would fall, but the way people talk about the relationship between historical racism and the wealth gap implies that those kinds of policies account for, you know, 90% or more of the racial wealth gap, which I don't buy. Again, because just, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but, you know, how much did it matter to the Japanese to have laws preventing them from owning property and land for 40 years? I don't know. I can't quantify that. I'm sure somebody, you know, I'm not even sure somebody has. I'm not sure people are even interested in that question, because it just so happens that for reasons having to do probably with culture and human capital, the Japanese have been, you know, quote unquote, outperforming whites on typical measures of success since the 1960s. So it's looking at, people are only interested to begin reasoning in that way when we have disparities on the ground today, which suggests that it's not, you know, people aren't reasoning in a totally disinterested way about this question. There's a clear motivation behind it, which is to explain disparities on the ground today, which ends up skewing the scholarship to attribute more causal power to racist policies than probably they deserve.
Okay. You don't dispute that someone like Ira Katznelson's arguments about the New Deal may have merit, that there was bias and that it had consequences. You just don't think it's as important as those who are propounding the arguments about racial wealth gap think. And you don't think it, we could put a percentage on it, we don't need to do that. But if you say at the outside that they are saying 90%, you're saying something more like 20 or 30%, something like that. And moreover, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, you're saying to focus the contemporary discussion on that 20 or 30%, if that's the right number, is not going to be particularly helpful at getting a solution to the problem.
Yes, that's true as well. But so, for example, I mentioned the Japanese and the Jews as minorities that were just discriminated against, but nevertheless did better than the majority. You can also think of minorities that did not experience any of those racist New Deal policies, but came here voluntarily, like, you know, Puerto Ricans to New York in the late 1950s. My grandparents were part of that wave, had many of the, virtually all of the same quote unquote social pathologies exhibited by Black New Yorkers in terms of out of wedlock births and crime. And obviously that wasn't caused by them being excluded by some racist policy 20 years ago. So there's a huge correlation without causation, a potential correlation without causation problem that infects this entire way of thinking about explaining modern disparities. And, you know, so that's what I'm getting at.
Okay, well, it sounds to me like it's time to talk about culture, because it seems to me that the flip side of your argument, as you say, there were two kind of prongs here. So on the one hand, what's the source of the inequality? Well, what it's not. It's not slavery and it's not the New Deal or whatever. It's not redlining. So then what is it? And it looks like you got an answer to that question too. And the answer is culture. Am I reading you wrong or what?
No, you're not reading me wrong.
So say something about that.
So there's such a thing as culture. It's by definition harder to study because you can't put culture in a beaker. You can't measure it. Many of the qualities that we refer to as culture are immeasurable. We're talking about attitudes towards education, what kinds of ideas you're exposed to growing up, the types of the kinds of cultural scripts that you fall into, the kind of social status games that you are taught to play, the rubric you're given for what it means to live a good life and to live a life as an authentic such and such, whatever you happen to be. These are very, very difficult issues. And there is a bias not to study them, to the point where Orlando Patterson, Harvard sociologist, who has done a lot of work on culture, jokingly calls it the C word, to indicate that sociologists treat it as if it's a taboo or off limits. So, you know, when it comes to Black culture, there are some ways, I think, to measure it. So if you just, I cite this Nielsen data in my piece, which is Nielsen, they're just counting, they're tracking consumer behavior. It's for market research. They're counting the degree to which people in different ethnic groups buy luxury cars, buy fancy jewelry. And they find that Black people on average buy more in both of those categories. Not conditional on wealth or income, just period, which is, I mean, you could say it's shocking, but on the other hand, when Dave Chappelle writes jokes about it, or Chris Rock writes jokes about how, you know, Black guys love like rims with, you know, their rims in their cars, somehow everyone in the room is laughing. So there's clearly a recognition, even on the part of Black people, that this is so. When I live in Harlem, just last night I was walking down to get some, you know, get something from the deli, and there's like, you know, a group of 20 Black kids, probably my age. All of them have jewelry and they're dressed in expensive clothes. And I would bet my life that they're not wealthy enough to justify necessarily having those clothes. And it's not a comment on it's not necessarily a comment on their intrinsic worth as people. They seem like perfectly good people. They were perfectly, you know, perfectly harmless. But why would we assume that it's the case that groups with entirely different histories, entirely different cultural values, would nevertheless behave exactly the same? And there's one, I mean, so for example, in politics, we know that Black people vote at a much higher level than Asians and Hispanics, like by 10 or 20 percentage points. Clearly, that's not a wealth thing. It's not like Black people have more money and therefore more time to go vote. It's just Black people have a much, at this moment in America, a much more political culture, probably having to do with the, I don't know, the legacy of the civil rights movement or whatnot. We can admit that and say, well, yeah, you know, that's not structural, that's just cultural. But why would politics be the only region where that's true? That would make no sense whatsoever. So I cite that data. I cite more data talking about financial habits, the degree to which you're, you know, being prudent with your finances. And what they find is even holding education constant, Asians have a better financial health score than whites, who have a better one than Hispanics, who have a better one than Blacks. And there's also Nielsen data, you know, talking about how many hours of TV are watched on the typical, in the typical household by race. And it, you know, it's Blacks are the highest, higher than Hispanics and whites. So what am I supposed to do? Ignore these facts, pretend they're not relevant? So what I say to frame this is, we don't have to necessarily be talking about disparities or racial disparities in outcome. In fact, I think that whole conversation is less useful than many people seem to think it is. It's not obvious that talking about gaps is a really useful framework for improving outcomes for people rather than just talking about, you know, making things better for those on the bottom in a race-blind way. But if we are going to talk about outcomes, if we're going to talk about racial disparities, then let's talk about racial disparities in inputs as well in order to be intellectually honest.
Yeah, that last is a really significant observation. I think I want to come back to it. I want to talk about culture for a minute. I appreciate the things that you had to say. I find myself personally very positively disposed toward your way of looking at the world here. And then we'll come back to talking about why are we talking about gaps, because I think that's really important. So about culture, it seems to me there are a number of questions. What is it? So we need a definitional thing. What are we talking about? And I think that's not a easy, not easy territory. I think there's some real subtleties there. But let's suppose that we can agree. I mean, I know what the common sense, you know, you're talking about norms, values, practices, you know, things that people value, institutions that, you know, structure families, how peer groups talk about who's a hero and who's a villain, and many other things besides, not to put words into your mouth. But yes, culture, we could have a discussion about where does it come from? So this is about the causality issue and about the extent to which cultural differences might be a reflection of oppression and dispossession and plunder and historical discrimination. And then, you know, does it really matter? Why does it matter? How can we fix it, quote unquote? Can we fix it, quote unquote? So all of these kind of issues come up. So I just want to put that on the table. We're going to be talking about culture. We need to be clear on what we're talking about. We need to be cognizant of the historical and sort of complex dynamics that produce cultural variation. And we need to be explicit about how it is that we think it matters for outcomes that we care about. I'm not saying you haven't done any of this. I'm just sort of laying this as a landscape. Now, and then I want to talk about, you know, why are we talking about gas, but I want to put that off. Now, in terms of some of the examples that you gave, so spending patterns, blacks disproportionately investing in visible luxury goods like automobiles and clothing and things like that relative to whites. And this, of course, is going to have an implication for wealth because if people are spending their surplus money on that, they're not saving it and having it accumulate over time. You are aware, are you not, of the study by, you mentioned University of Chicago data. I'm not sure if you were referring to Kerwin Charles and John Gurian. They have an article in the economics scholarly literature on conspicuous consumption and race. And they start by using their data to document exactly what you said, which is there's a higher expenditure by blacks on luxury goods, and they were controlling for income. And if it's true without controlling for income, that's extraordinary since blacks have lower income. But in any case, it's not inconsistent with what you said. But they then go on to make the following argument. And I'm talking about where does cultural variation come from? That's what I'm addressing myself to. Now, they go on to make the following argument. They say, the reason why people will perhaps spend on luxury visible goods is they want to signal that they are relatively successful in comparison to their peers. So who are their peers? So if you're black and you live in an urban area, your peers are other blacks in urban areas. How would you signal? Now, you could put your money into a stock portfolio, but no one could see that. You could also put your money into a BMW high-end vehicle, and people could see that. If you want to be marked as a successful person by onlookers, and you are, in terms of your basic presentation, a member of a group that's not very successful, the way you signal that is by visible luxury consumption. And then they go on to say, that can account for the racial differences because we see the very same behavior among whites. They take data comparing whites in the northeast of the U.S., where whites on the whole are relatively prosperous, to whites in the south of the United States, where whites on the whole are less prosperous. And they find that the whites in the south spend more controlling for income on visible luxury goods, consumption goods, than do whites in the northeast, consistent with their theory that the underlying cause of the variation has to do with the desire of a relatively successful person who can afford it but who belongs to a group that is on the whole not so successful to be marked publicly as a success. Now, that took me longer to say than I wish it had taken. The point I'm trying to make is that I've observed the racial difference in this case in expenditure patterns, but I haven't identified a racial phenomenon. What I've identified is a phenomenon that happens to have a racial manifestation, but has a universal root. And one could, you know, one could manufacture, I can manufacture examples of this kind ad infinitum. The structure of all of these examples, let me give an extreme one. Violence, murder, homicide. There is a huge racial disparity. It's on the order of magnitude in the incidence of violence and the incidence of homicide. What could be more a reflection of cultural difference than that? Of differences between subgroups within the United States and how much they value life and the extent to which they can exert impulse control and the internalized prohibition that they feel about inflicting harm upon other people. What could be more of a kind of rooted cultural phenomenon than behavior of that kind? So an observer might say. On the other hand, a more subtle and deeply thinking observer might notice that the motives for committing acts of violence are complex. So, for example, retaliation. When does retaliation? Preemption. I took the act of violence before the person acted against me. This kind of thing. Okay. Strategic phenomena. So if I know that the likelihood that a homicide is going to actually be solved is 0.2 and not 0.9, and I'm in a situation where someone threatens me, I have to think that they might commit homicide against me because the likelihood that they will be caught is low. But if I can commit homicide against them first and prevent them from considering homicide against me, the likelihood that I'll be caught is low. This thing creates an environment where maybe I want to go ahead and commit this act of homicide. This could be a sick systematic behavioral pattern within a relatively isolated community, like the high school dropout, unemployed, African-American, west side of Chicago resident who maybe knows 5,000 people. His whole universe consists of this interlocked structure of social relations amongst people relatively like himself. And I find that there's super high rates of violence in this population. And I conclude, I attribute it to a, quote, cultural phenomenon. Do you see what I'm getting at, Coleman? I'm trying to say, what is culture and what does variation in culture across population subgroups depend upon? And to what extent can I make a mistake of essentializing, of attributing it to something I'm calling Black culture, when in fact it's a much more finely grained and specifiable consequence of, yes, structural implication. I'm not trying to let anybody off the hook. I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not Ta-Nehisi Coates making excuses for the thing. I'm saying we have to be very disciplined in how it is that we talk about it when we're invoking these cultural. What's your response to that?
I completely agree. So what you're doing right now, which is good, and you're thinking like a subtle social scientist, which is what you are. You're thinking about like how far do I zoom in the microscope so that I can talk about what's under the lens in a coherent way without being grossly misleading or without missing big pieces of variation in the data. Why not do that with the racial wealth gap to begin, though? This is what I'm saying. When the statistic we're trying to explain is just a broad Black versus white, this is Black wealth, this is white wealth, look how different they are, then I'm forced to talk about the inputs at the same scale. If I want to push back, I can't just start talking about this subgroup of Black men between 18 and 25, which might be a more interesting conversation and a more subtle one, but I'm forced in order to address the argument to talk at the scale of the argument that I'm addressing, which is already very unsubtle. So that would be one response. The second response is obviously that wouldn't account necessarily for when, if you like hold income or neighborhood constant and you still find some cultural, well, some behavioral differences, let's say, culture should still be an explanatory variable that's at least on the table to be discussed. So I guess those would be my two responses to that.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
I want to say one more thing.
Please.
Which is, I think Amy Alkin wrote a response to my piece talking about the, I guess, evolutionary psychological logic and kind of game theoretic logic of conspicuously buying visible goods, kind of similar to the argument you gave, a little bit different. So if you live in a scenario where many young men die young, it makes more sense to try to become as high status as possible or flaunt your high status as possible as quickly as possible, because playing the long game makes less sense just given your options in life, or you're like expected value on going to school and not being wealthy until you're 40 versus like trying to do something to get rich, like a, you know, get rich quick scheme and then flaunt that wealth immediately actually is more logical in a scenario where, you know, your expected lifespan is shorter. So, I mean, I think all those caveats can be true. I hesitate to give too much weight to those arguments though, because, you know, there's nothing more normal throughout history than a group starting out completely dirt poor and rising within one or two generations. Yeah. If it were the case that poverty inevitably led to this kind of competitive status display that was self-undermining in terms of wealth creation, then no one ever would have escaped poverty to begin with. So those things can be true, but it's a question of how big those effects are and whether those effects themselves aren't influenced by culture.
Yeah, I think we're onto something here that's of real significance. And I'm stimulated by this question you posed that Orlando Patterson motivates, which is, why are sociologists or academics more generally so reluctant to examine the cultural root of disparities? And I think I have an answer to that question. And I think it has to do with the relationship between politics, which is, you know, like a struggle over the state, over, you know, how much redistribution, over how to what extent are private property rights compromised and limited by public action. And the extent of taxation, the expansiveness of welfare state generosity, the, you know, et cetera, politics on the one hand, and narratives that we construct in the academy because we're basically storytellers over here. I mean, yeah, we're social scientists, and I thank you, subtle social scientists, more or less, you know, doing analysis, looking at data. But at the end of the day, basically what we're doing is constructing narratives. And we are, that is, explaining the broad patterns. I like your distinction between granular, down on the ground level thing. You say you're forced to deal in these tropes and these large kind of things, in part because you're trying to oppose arguments that formulate in those terms. I like that point. I think that point is right. But as a matter of fact, the actual texture of social outcomes, very complicated, and you do see these patterns, inequality between groups and whatnot, and then you're moved to try to give an account of it. And so there's a question about narrative. And I think the issue here is the relationship between narrative and politics. So let me give some examples. Moynihan, The Black Family, 1960s. So he writes a report, Structured Black Family. So he gets a big brouhaha. Everybody knows about this. Books have been written about. Very good book by my colleague, the historian James Patterson, here at Brown on the Moynihan Report, which I commend to anybody, which tells the history of this controversy. But the bottom line is, he looks in the mid-60s at a quarter of African-American children born to unmarried women, compared to like 5 or 8% of whites, 10%. And he says, oh, look out, we're going to have a problem. And then everybody calls him a racist. And, you know, he's blaming the victim. And there's this whole kind of shutdown. And then for, you know, like 30, 40 years, anybody's afraid to say anything about the Black family because they don't want to be Moynihan. So what's at stake? Okay. So at stake is the narrative. Whose fault is it? We say it doesn't matter about fault. All that matters is solution. Well, no, it matters a lot about fault because fault kind of pins down the narrative in a way. I mean, that's kind of what we're arguing about. We're arguing about the extent to which the structures of society, which are reformable through progressive political intervention, are responsible for the disparate outcome, as opposed to the behaviors, beliefs, values, anticipations, child-rearing practices, the inner relations between the sexes, structure of their families, character of the peer group influences, you know, ideals, norms, and whatnot are responsible for the outcome. That narrative is conservative. That narrative complements a minimal state. It goes along with Charles Murray's losing ground argument about we had a war on poverty and poverty won. It goes along with the people who don't want to make taxes too high, with the people who say every tub on its own bottom, with the people who say, get out of the wagon and help the rest of us push. Those narratives, the narrative of explanation, mm-hmm. values, norms, practices, behaviors, and the institutions of these impoverished communities are themselves substantially implicated in the impoverishment of those residents, complements minimal state, low taxes, don't try to intervene too much. It's not my problem what goes on over there, politics. Mm-hmm. Whereas, Ta-Nehisi Coates' argument, or others like it, you plundered, the country wouldn't be rich but for stealing from these people. They never had a chance. Their citizenship was truncated from day one. They're excluded. They're marginalized. Of course, they're killing each other. Because what else would you expect them to do? They're rats in a barrel when you got your hand on the lid. They're fighting at each other to get to crawl up to the top and get a breath of fresh air, kind of thing like that. Compliments. We want big government. We want the United States has only got 25% of the GDP being spent by the federal government. Germany has got 40%, and Sweden has got 60%. We ought to be more like Germany and more like Sweden. Those things fit together. This is really a battle about politics. The narrative complements the political agendas of fundamentally opposed forces, and Black people, in this case, are pawns in that game. Mm.
I completely agree, and I've thought very much the same thing about the Moynihan Report, and just loop in the crime wave of the 60s and 70s and 80s and the spike in single-parent homes there's been an intellectual battle about what caused that, and that the stakes are completely political, because if the right-wing narrative is correct and it was a consequence of the welfare state, that has massive implications. If the left-wing narrative is correct and it was a consequence of deindustrialization and structure and bad government policy, but insufficiently generous government policy, that also has massive implications. And hyper-punitiveness in terms of, criminogenic prisons and whatnot. And so I've been wrestling with that question for a long time and gone back and forth on it in many ways. And I think it's a very complex question, and neither of the narratives is quite right. And then I came across this book called Lucifer Curves by the economist Rick Nevin. Do you know this?
No, I don't. I know the name Rick Levin, but I don't know Lucifer Curves.
Yeah, so Rick Nevin wrote this book in which he's talking about essentially the rise and fall of blood lead levels in different populations.
Oh.
And it sounds like a conspiracy theory at first, but then when you look at the data, blood lead levels in children correlate with, almost all of these pathologies, both the rise and the fall in America, in Europe, at places where, lead came into, where blood lead levels rose first, you saw crime rising first.
I see.
And if you break it down by age, you get exactly the correlations you would predict, suggesting that it's lead rather than the other causes posited by both conservative and progressive intellectuals. I think that's one that kind of cut through a lot of, a lot of other arguments that I felt are made about what happened in the 60s and 70s in this country. And it's not clear what the political implications of that argument other than obviously make gas unleaded, which we already did. And it kind of puts us back at square one, which is how do we create the consequences for people, the best consequences for people starting in 2019, which I think is the most relevant question now. And I think we should probably stop fighting about what caused the rise in single parent homes.
Okay. And should we also stop focusing our attention on racial gaps?
Yes, I think we should. So the pathological thing about focusing on racial gaps is that it makes us define our notion of progress in a way that would be very counterintuitive if it were any other conversation. So say you and I were driving from New York to California, you started, a day before I did, and you're 400 miles ahead of me or whatever. And now we're driving. Let's say I'm 1,000 miles from New York at this point, but still 400 miles behind you. Should I define progress by the fact that I haven't closed the gap with you at all, or the fact that I've made 1,000 miles from New York, right? Under one paradigm, I've made no progress at all. And under another paradigm, I've made a heck of a lot of progress. So the way we talk about gaps is very counterintuitive to me, because we're talking about groups with entirely different histories and therefore entirely different migration patterns, entirely different values at the mean. So why would we expect them? Why would we be measuring them against one another? Moreover, there's something a little arguably racist about, at least I could see how it could be construed as racist under a very capacious definition of racism, about taking whatever the white median or mean is for some statistic, whether it's wealth, and assuming that that's like normal. Anything below that is something to be bemoaned, and anything above that is like, well, Asians, they're just somehow doing better than expected. It's like, no, white people are also a group with that can be broken into many subgroups, but that have a specific history, a specific culture. They're by no means like the default group to measure other groups against and draw conclusions from whether they fall short or ahead. I was just talking to Ian, I'm blanking on his last name, charter school.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And he was saying, another way of making the same point, why are we aiming for white kids, for the average white, like, rate of being proficient at reading? It's actually kind of abysmal. Like, why is that our implicit aim? It's not clear to me why that should be the case, rather than just looking at how we can be increasing scores in general across the board. How can we be increasing wealth in general across the board?
Well, let me answer why are we looking at the gaps. The implicit model is that in the default counterfactual where there was no racial discrimination, there would be an equal outcome. And hence, the gap is an indirect measure of the consequence of racial discrimination. This is, you know, with that model, if that's your specification, if that's what you think is going on, you've got some relationship between inputs and outputs. And you got to think about the endowments and capacities of people. Of course, we're assuming those a priori to be racially equal. Otherwise, we would be, you know, we'd be racist. We'd be white supremacists if we hadn't made any assumption about that, other than that they were racially equal. And I'm making that assumption. Let me assume that the inherent capacities and abilities of people don't vary by race. The Asians are not intrinsically smarter than the whites. The whites are not intrinsically smarter than the blacks. And that I think the outcome is a function of people's effort. And I don't want to assume those are different either. Because what am I saying then? You blacks are lazy? That's an unacceptable stereotype of effort, ability, and we're stipulating those things to be equal at the outset, and then opportunity. So then when I see a disparate outcome by race, the reason I'm looking at the gap by race is because my default hypothetical counterfactual is I'd have equality but for racial discrimination. The only issue is how much racial discrimination is there, and that's a measure of how much differences there are in these outcomes. I mean, this is the It's Elizabeth Warren, if I'm not mistaken, is now running. Oh, no, it's Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is now running, amongst other things, on the idea that corporations should be paying equal pay to men and women for work that's similar, because she says the so-called unexplained pay gap is a measure of the discrimination against women. It's the same basic philosophical premise, which is the absent unfairness, there would be an equal outcome. So the gap is a measure of the extent of unfairness. So that's the answer to the question. Why are they looking at it? Of course, you and I reject the model. We reject the assumption that there's equality of effort. I assume we stipulate that there's equality of ability, although I could get into a long discussion with you about why we ought to stipulate that. Because isn't one another implication of your way of looking at the world that we should allow for the possibility that there would be differences? If you're willing a priori to simply assume that there's no differences in the intrinsic abilities of the groups, why would you object to somebody who assumes that there's no difference in the intrinsic cultures of the groups?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, obviously the model taken to its logical conclusion implies that we should be talking about, you know, why Asians have higher incomes than whites.
Yeah.
We should be wondering whether whites are discriminated against relative to Asians or Jews or, you know, the highest. So
okay,
taken to its logical conclusion, that's what the model suggests. You know, I don't buy that model. I think there is so much evidence from multi-ethnic societies across the world where that model leads to absurdities, where you're positing advantages for groups that are suffering pogroms, you know, like the Igbo in Nigeria or the Chinese in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
we're getting near the end of our time. I just want to add one more thought, and this is kind of a thought of my own. It's stimulated to some degree by your work, but it's a thought of my own, and that's about another reason why this colorblind, you called it colorblind, everyone would get upset if you use those words, why this not focusing on the gaps between the races, but thinking about the structures that face individuals and then thinking about what makes sense in terms of our reforms or whatever we want to do in terms of those structures and where do these differences come from, and being candid and having a micro focus on those differences. And I think another reason to get out of the gap, the racial gap business, is political in the broadest sense of that term. It is making the discussion a discussion about human beings and not about groups. This is an anti-identity politics speech. People get mad. You're not supposed to say it. But that basically the frustrations that the limitations, the impediments, the unfairnesses and injustices, the disappointments, the lost opportunities that confront us are not racial. They are part of the human condition. There really is no justification for attacking black poverty independently of attacking poverty. This is the argument that I'm going to try to fashion here. There's no justification for thinking about homelessness in racial terms. There is no justification for thinking about the extent of over-incarceration in the country, notwithstanding the huge racial disparity in its incidence. Primarily in racial terms, it's about how we as a country deal with our fellow citizens who have broken our laws and what's required of us and what's required of them. There's no justification for thinking about political representation. That is, the extent to which citizens have their membership in our political community effectively expressed in the deliberations of our government, primarily in racial terms. I know that's a radical thing to say, but I believe it to be true. The American Republic, structured and constructed in that way by seeing people as members of these groups, betrays the potentiality of the founding. That's oh, the founders were slave owners. I know that. I know that the founders were slave owners, but the founding was not a slave expression, and its instantiation in the 21st century and the hope that it has for the world is most effectively thought of in human and not racial terms. Clarence Thomas is right about that. Again, you all can get mad at me if you want to. This man who sits on the Supreme Court and has done so for a quarter century, who's 1/9 of 1/3 of the American state, who comes up out of the sea islands off of the coast of Georgia and is as Black and African-American as anybody will ever be, who addresses himself to fundamental questions of constitutional interpretation through the experience of his Black life, is right to interpret the founding of the U.S. government in the late 18th century and the refounding of it in the middle of the 19th century, primarily in individual terms. That's the best path forward for this country. Oh, no, very controversial, but it's right. And therefore, if you take that philosophical premise, it is very natural to think about remedies for social inequality in individual and not in racial terms, to think about the loss to the country from unrealized human potential in individual and not racial terms. There are white people in the hill country of eastern Kentucky. There are white people in the slums on the south side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or whatever it might be. There are white people who are unemployed in the small, dusty towns of the failing mining districts and so forth and so on. It's the wrong way to think about America. The fact that it has captured the imagination of woke progressives is much to their discredit.
I agree. And I would add that from my perspective, what you're asking for and what I'm asking for is actually not nearly as radical as it seems, because we're already not thinking in terms of racial gaps on almost every gap that exists. Nobody is losing sleep over the fact that the NBA is 3/4 Black. Nobody is losing sleep over the fact that if you compare white Americans of French descent to white Americans of Russian descent, there's a 21-cent income gap. Nobody is losing sleep over innumerable racial and ethnic disparities. And all I'm asking for is you to cease losing sleep over one more. So it's actually not nearly as radical as it seems.
Okay, Colvin, it's an hour of interesting conversation with you. Colvin Cruz Hughes, philosophy major at Columbia University and writer at Quillette.com. I really appreciate you giving us some time at the Glenn Show. Watch the comments. There will be pushback, I assure you.
I'm well acquainted with my critics at this point. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Colvin. We'll sign off for now.
Sure.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.